Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We are one or two members short of a quorum, so we won't be official yet, but as soon as we are, we'll move the bill so it's in front of us. We are working first on House File 954. Representative Schumacher, we should have enough for a quorum here in a moment, but we'll get started. So if you want to proceed, start when you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 954 deals with long-term care insurance and is an effort to adjust the minimum inflation protection level that state mandates have for long-term care partnership policies from the 3% requirement to 1%. Consumers can already purchase products on the market that don't have the 3% inflation mandate, but the partnership coverages are currently excluded from those products. This adjustment will allow for greater flexibility in the policies sold and will drive down the policy prices to make long-term care insurance more affordable for more middle-class Minnesotans. The proposal in front of you today is supported by the Department of Commerce and is part of Governor Dayton's Own Your Future campaign. And with that, I welcome Robin Rowan to the testifying table to offer more information and answer your questions.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. And Ms. Rowan, just one moment, please. We are now official. We have a quorum, so I will move House File 954 so it is properly before us. And Representative Swiedzinski, I think, would like to move the minutes from our last meeting.
Yes.
Representative Swiedzinski moves the minutes. Members, are there any comments, concerns, or questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of Swiedzinski's motion to approve the minutes from our last meeting, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. House File 954 is properly in front of us. Ms. Rowan, please proceed.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, or MFSI. MFSI members provide financial security to Minnesotans through the sale of life, long-term care, annuities, 401k plans, and other retirement products. MFSI members have approximately 65,000 jobs in this state, including the agents that distribute our products in every corner of the state. As Representative Schumacher said, what this bill does, it's actually one of the smallest changes I've seen in a bill. It just changed a 3-1, but we're hoping it has a big impact on the long-term care market. What we discovered through market research is that the 3% rider that's required by law is actually pricing people out of the marketplace. And it's pricing exactly the people out of the marketplace that we want to be buying long-term care insurance policies with a 1% inflation protection rider. A couple could save over $100 a month or $1,400 a year. We also discovered with the 3% protection rider that people are paying for more coverage than they actually use. A recent study by the largest long-term care rider in the country found that only people are only using 67% of their benefit. And this is partially because of the advent of home care. People would rather have care in their home than be in a nursing home, and nursing home care in Minnesota is rising at less than 1%. So basically, lower protection policies with lower protection levels, like the 1%, will bring more people into the market and provide more meaningful coverage. And it also increases the CE credits for long-term care. No, I'm just kidding. It does not do that. Strike that. I just wanted to see if Representative Davids was listening.
His hand was already going up. Thank you, Ms. Rowan. Members, any questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Schumacher, where would you like the bill to go? We haven't heard that it needs to go anywhere else other than the floor. Okay, then Representative Schumacher, we'll give you the last word.
Please vote for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher, for the eloquence. We appreciate eloquence and brevity in equal measure. I will renew my motion that House File 954 be re-referred to the General Register, and with that, we'll take the roll. Those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schumacher and Ms. Rowan. House File 954 is on its way to the General Register. Representative Schumacher, welcome to the committee. House File 921. I will move House File 921 so that it is officially before us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 921 establishes a long-term care savings plan. In the state and in the nation, we basically only have one option if we're trying to plan for our own long-term care, and we just heard about it in the last bill. That's long-term care insurance. And what I've seen from my own personal experiences and from surveys that have come out of the University of Boston and places such as that, that long-term care insurance isn't the answer for everybody. And so this establishes a long-term care savings account. It's modeled after legislation that was passed in Nebraska back in 2007. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's like a health savings account. You can use the savings for qualified expenses, and you can invest in there with a tax shelter at the state level for up to $1,000 a year. The MMB is the one who would be administering the product as it is. They can contract out for others to administrate it as well, and it's up to them on how they go from there. And members, I would ask you for your support so that people can start saving for themselves for their long-term care, not rely on the state for all of those expenses, and be able to have options as they grow older.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Members, any questions? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would the next stop be for this bill? Did we say? I didn't catch
it. I didn't say it in the motion, but I believe it's HHS Finance.
And then we're after that.
That would depend on you, I think, Representative Davids.
I think it probably should be going to tax, talking about tax deductions, tax this, tax that. So,
our general rule is if it says the word tax less than a half a dozen times, it shouldn't have to go, but... we always defer to you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I guess that's for another day.
Okay. Well, Representative Schumacher, I think we'll send it to HHS Finance and then from there to the Tax Committee, if that's all right with you.
That sounds great.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody coming down. We'll give you the final word. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, as you well know, I'm working on... tax credits for long-term care as well. Would this work in tandem with or choosing between the savings account or the tax credit?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. It would work in concert with that. These would not be conflicting. However, for those who are able to partake in long-term care insurance, we would encourage them to take the long-term care insurance. But for those who can't afford, even with the increased tax credits that your bill offer, we want to have another option for those people who can't afford the premiums or have a steady premium that they can't budget for those types of things. We want them to have an option as well. This also alleviates any prior health concerns that may be attached to that may drive up premiums if they can even qualify for long-term care insurance. This offers an option for those people as well that can't get it. So I would say that it's in tangent with what your efforts are trying to do.
Mr. Chair?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so happy that you are a chair for long-term care. And this year, you're doing a great job, Representative Schumacher.
Wow.
I'm sorry, was that a question? Representative Davids.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how good he's doing in his committee. I don't go there that often. But I'm sure it's exemplary. But that being said...
Mr. Chair, I'd like to defend Representative Schumacher's honor and integrity. He's doing a good job.
Exemplary means good, Representative Lynch.
He's doing a good job.
I'm sure.
Representative David.
He's quite affable and gregarious. So. With that being said, I think one bigger point we're kind of missing is I think you just touched on it, Mr. Chairman, is that this isn't just for folks that might not be able to afford long-term care, because if they can't afford long-term care, who cares about this, because you're going to go on the system anyways. Where this is so important in my mind is that there's a lot of people can't buy long-term care because of health reasons. Long-term care is a very, very tough contract to get. We have a lot of folks that when you send it in and get denied, you have to have quite the positive health history, and this would make it so somebody could, you know, start building up funds for long-term care, whether it be nursing home or in-home daycare or whatever it is. So I think this is a very good bill, and I can see several O'Driscoll bills. I think Representative Keel has a bill, somebody else, that we could merge some of these together and put a pretty good long-term care package together. So thanks for bringing this bill. And I'm sure you do a good job. I'm not here to question that.
Well, no, I think he is doing a very good job. Other questions, members? Nobody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schumacher. I've kind of been thinking about this for a while because I've heard the bill a couple times. But with a HSA, you can use part of your savings to pay for your premiums. Do you know if you would be able to do that with the long-term care policy? Would you be able to use some of your savings plans to do that?
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Tice. You would. There's nothing that would restrict you in this bill from doing that.
I think that's it. Thank you, Representative Tice. Not seeing any further questions, Representative Schumacher will again give you the final word.
I'm going to take the advice of Chairman Davids and shut up and sell.
That sounds good. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 921 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance, please. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you for your attendance here today, Representative Schumacher. And with that, we will move to Representative Mack. House File 1246. Representative Mack, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And Representative Mack, I will go ahead and move House File 1246. And move that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an author's amendment, which I believe is coded the A3 amendment.
That's the amendment we have in our packet.
Yep.
We'll go ahead and we'll put that amendment on to get the bill in the shape that you would like it to be in, and then I'll let you go ahead and explain your bill. All those in favor of the adoption of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Mack, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, the bill in front of you today is one that I think has a lot of exciting prospects to it. A theme of this session, particularly when it comes to health and human services reform, is looking for reforms that will take us into the future, address access issues, help some of the access issues in the rural communities around the state, and make sure that no matter where you live, you have access to the same quality of care. And members, it's no secret that we have a healthcare workforce issue in our state, and there's a lot of good work being done this session to try to address that. However, that's a pipeline. The results are not going to be immediate. That's going to be 10, 12, 14 years down the line until we start to see some of the real results of trying to develop our workforce. And so I believe that House File 1246 that builds on telemedicine is going to be a little bit more of an immediate fix, bring some relief to the access issues in the very near future. And so, members, I just want to kind of go over high level with the bill, and then we do have some people to walk us through and kind of explain also exactly what the amendment's doing. We've been doing a lot of good work with the providers and the health plans, and I won't sit in front of you and tell you that we are completely arrived at consensus on this bill, but we've come a long ways. Both sides have made a lot of concessions trying to work together, and I'm encouraged by that, and that will continue as we move forward. Members, I just want to highlight why we think telemedicine is an important thing for the state of Minnesota. Telemedicine allows individuals to receive care locally without necessarily having to travel long distances to seek care in the large metropolitan areas. Telemedicine certainly makes care more convenient for the patient. If you have a child that needs specialty care services, maybe they need to seek services at one of our great children's hospitals here in the Twin Cities. But the fact is, taking off work, having to commute them down to the Twin Cities can be a very inconvenient thing for a very inconvenient thing for families. And so by providing that we would access or expand telemedicine services, it could become a reality where those families could stay in their own communities, go to their local providers, and get the care that they need without the inconvenience of traveling. Telemedicine enables providers to deliver life-saving care such as emergency and stroke care more quickly without the risk, delays, and cost of transporting the patient via ambulance or helicopter. Telemedicine extends the reach of scarce specialty services. This, of course, can mean cost savings, but more importantly, it can be life-saving for the patient. The key elements of this telemedicine bill are it updates the definition of telemedicine to keep pace with technological innovations, and it requires public and private insurance plans to treat and pay for services delivered using telemedicine technology, the same as services that would be delivered in person. For clarification, I just want to emphasize a couple of the things that this bill does not do. This bill does not expand any provider's current scope of practice. This bill does not force a health plan to pay for services that are not already covered services under the plan that the patient has purchased. This plan does not take away health plans' rights to negotiate the rates that they pay providers for services. And this bill does not require a health plan to pay providers with whom it does not have a contract or otherwise require a plan to expand its provider network. Members, I just want to emphasize the fact that this really is an issue of both convenience as well as reform in terms of leveraging the amazing power of technology to further our health care goals here in the state of Minnesota. And I also just want to point out that we have an incredible resource of healthcare professionals here in this state and specialties right here in the Twin Cities at Rochester Mayo. But the reality is that if you don't live in those metropolitan areas, you might not have access to those specialty or without at least having to jump through quite a few hoops to get access to them. And we believe that providing a way for providers in the rural areas to be incentivized to invest in the telemedicine technology, that would expand the access to those specialty cares that a lot of people do rely on. So with that, Mr. Chair, in that high-level overview, we could go to testifiers and go from there.
All right. Representative Mack, thank you. And while we have, I think Mary Krinke is our first testifier, and while she's coming down, I know Representative Dean has a question as well, but I want to thank you, and I think some of the members on the committee know you've put a lot of effort into this, but I also want to thank the opponents and the proponents of this bill, Ms. Krinke, Ms. Kmit, and others that have put in a lot of time and a lot of work on this, and I think started pretty far apart, way out on the plains, and they're getting closer to the valley. I don't know that we have peace in the valley yet, but I know that this isn't the final stop for this bill, and I very much appreciate everybody's willingness to keep working on this. So thank you. Representative Dean has a question. Do you have it for the author or testifiers, whatever your preference?
You know, at some point, hopefully someone will give an answer to this. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. As I'm looking at this bill, I'm thinking, wouldn't it be great if we were somehow measuring the effectiveness of this as a way of delivering, you know, medical care. So, and I didn't see anything in the bill that talks about anybody, like, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now doing a study to see if the care is as effective as in-office care or maybe even more effective as office care. And I just throw that out as an idea to you as well as other individuals to consider something, because it's great for us to do this. But if we're not actually improving healthcare and it's just saving costs, then maybe it's not the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Well said. And for those that have delicate hearing, I'll just let you know at the end of the hearing today, for those that missed it, Representative Lunin played the bagpipes in at the end of the House session today. He will be playing the bagpipes in here at the end of the Commerce Committee today, and it could get a little loud down here, so you might want to prepare yourselves. With that, Representative Mack, if we want to go to testifiers. Welcome, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm Senior Vice President of Policy and Strategy for the Minnesota Hospital Association. I am not Mary Krinke, but I am proud to be here and to talk about the bill. As Representative Mack said, this bill does not require coverage for anything that is not already a covered benefit that people are paying premiums to receive. It does not require any health plan to include a provider in its network that it is not already contracted with to be in its network. And it does not require health plans to extend services in areas where they don't already provide coverage or have enrollees. I want to reference a couple of recent task forces and efforts within Minnesota regarding our healthcare workforce and our healthcare system as a whole. Health Force and Minnesota State Colleges and Universities over the past year studied the mental health workforce in Minnesota and what we need to do to change that in a report to the legislature titled Gearing Up for Action, Mental Health Workforce Plan for Minnesota. One of the recommendations from that report is, quote, support efforts to expand and broaden mental health telemedicine, and goes on to specifically recommend require commercial health plans to cover services delivered via telehealth technology. The Blue Ribbon Task Force on the University of Minnesota Medical School also had telemedicine recommendations. And the Minnesota Business Partnership, in its blueprint for healthcare reform in January of 2015, recommended, quote, remove outdated and artificial barriers to efficient delivery of health care, such as barriers to telemedicine. This bill is an attempt to expand telemedicine, and when you think of telemedicine, think of where the patient is located. Almost inevitably, where the patient is located is somewhere where there isn't adequate access to whatever services that patient is looking for, whether it's specialty services, primary care services, pediatric services, you name it. And so what telemedicine does is it allows that patient to be able to get access within his or her own community more efficiently, less time off of work, less time away from school, less time on the road, both for the patient and for providers. With respect to the question from Representative Dean, telemedicine has been studied for more than 20 years with respect to cost effectiveness and quality of outcomes. I'm not going to go through all of those studies, but I want to highlight a couple of recent ones. One from Health Affairs in June 2012 on costs for a program called Hospital at Home, where patients are able to stay in their own home and receive hospital inpatient level care. Using telemedicine to deliver acute hospital-level services within the patient's home under a model developed by Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, a study from New Mexico found that patients had comparable or better clinical outcomes compared with similar patients treated in the hospital. Importantly, patients had higher satisfaction scores. During the test period, the cost of care for patients in the hospital at home program were 19% lower than similar patients, and most of these savings came from lower average length of stay in the hospital, fewer lab and diagnostic tests, all resulting in better outcomes and faster recovery for the patient. Another study of 17,000 veterans, I should say the Veterans Department is one of the most aggressive in using telemedicine, and it plans to expand the use of that. Study based on 17,000 veterans with chronic conditions who received telemedicine care coordination as routine non-institutional care showed a 25% reduction in the number of inpatient hospital bed days, a 19% reduction in the number of hospital admissions, and an average patient satisfaction score of 85%. And I quote, the results demonstrate a dramatic reduction in costs and an equally dramatic increase in quality. If members like, I have an entire series of studies on ICU stays, tele-ER, teledermatology, you name it, that have been studied showing at equal or better quality outcomes for patients, better access to care, shorter commutes, higher patient satisfaction, and dramatically lower costs when telemedicine is used. The biggest barrier to telemedicine today is around reimbursement. Health plans today, while I want to be clear, Minnesota health plans cover telemedicine, but they pick and choose which services they want to cover and how much they want to pay, dramatically limiting providers' ability to invest in the technology and infrastructure if they're only going to get paid by some of the plans for some of the patients. I also want to emphasize that this is not just about hospital or clinic level care. One of the images I want to put in your mind is the notion of the nursing home patient. You just had two long-term care bills before you. Think of the nursing home patient that can receive care in the nursing home via telemedicine and avoid an ambulance or other commute to a hospital emergency room. Not only the cost savings of the commute, the transport, the ambulance, the ER service, but the ability to stay in their home and receive care there is a significant improvement in their quality of life. So with that, I would recommend and encourage you, the Minnesota Hospital Association strongly supports this bill. We've been want to thank Representative Mack for all of her work and support as we've gone along the way. And I will be open for questions whenever that time is appropriate.
Mr. Anderson, thank you. Why don't you stay there in case there are questions. Representative Mack, do you have another testifier proponent of the bill?
Not that I know of,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Well, I know Ms. Commit wanted to come down and say a word on the bill, and she's already down there. So I panicked for a minute. I looked back there and didn't see you. Ms. Commit, welcome back to the committee. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name, again, is Catherine Kmit from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to make some brief comment today on this bill. I especially want to thank Representative Mack for the amendment and the Hospital Association. We've been working with the Hospital Association. I believe we're making good progress. I think there is still some more work to do on this bill, but we are working towards a compromise. So I want everybody to know that. We support the use of telemedicine as a tool for improving patient access to care. When used appropriately, telemedicine can remove certain barriers to health care, such as distance, mobility, and time constraints. And I want to just pick up on the question that Representative Dean had asked, and say that we are always interested in trying to measure care to improve the quality, because if we improve quality, it improves the patient experience and it helps to drive down the cost. So all of those things are very important, and so I think that's a very good point and maybe something that we ought to look at for the bill, to look further at how we measure the quality and the effectiveness of telemedicine. In today's competitive health insurance marketplace, health plans are focusing their efforts in the direction of outcome-based care. So this gets at Representative Dean's issue, and using innovative payment reform models to incent providers to improve care, improve healthcare quality, and reduce the costs. These payment reform models do include the use of telemedicine. One of the issues that we're still discussing with the Hospital Association and with Representative Mack is we understand the intent of this bill is so that providers can be assured they'll be reimbursed for their costs before installing a telemedicine infrastructure. In effect, this bill imposes a mandate that falls disproportionately on the individual and small group markets, and for which the state will have some cost. We believe this will increase premiums and have a cost to the state. Now, that may be the public policy direction that the legislature wants to go in, and that is fine, but we just want to be sure that that's on the record, and we think that that is an outcome to be expected. We continue to look at how to address the bill to make it more cost-effective. We think telemedicine should help to provide greater convenience and access to care for patients, as well as reduce healthcare costs. Again, we're making a lot of progress, I am pleased to say, and I look forward to continued progress. With that, I'll stop and answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kmit. Members, any questions for either of the testifiers? Mr. Anderson and Ms. Kmit, Peggy, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to see if the negotiations are going on from here, or if Representative Mack feels and the other folks feel that they're settled on this, or just what the plan of action is.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. No, the amendment that we put on the bill is further progress towards peace on this bill, but no, we are not there yet. There are still some things that we need to figure out and negotiate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. Just would encourage you to keep up the negotiations. I think the cost issue is one that probably needs to be figured out at some time. So, thank you.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mack. Thanks for bringing this forward. This is it's important to think about what the future of healthcare is, and I think telemedicine is a big part of that future. A couple of questions that I have regarding how things are now and how things that will be. First of all, are there reimbursements going on currently for telemedicine, and are those kind of part of contract negotiations, or are they on a catch-as-catch-can basis, or how are those happening currently?
Representative Mack.
Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson, thanks for the question. I actually meant to say this in my introduction and acknowledge the fact that telemedicine is going on, and it is being covered by plans, by some of the products that they have. The issue, as I understand it, and maybe our testifiers want to weigh in on this also, is that there can be quite a bit of discrepancy on what's reimbursed. You could have the same service provided in person or via telemedicine, and there could be a fairly large gap. So while they are being covered, they're not being covered at the same rate via telemedicine as they would be for an in-person visit. And so part of what the bill stipulates right now is that where medically necessary, telemedicine could be used and reimbursed at the same rate as an in-person visit would be. And what, you know, the goal being that for some of these small providers in the rural areas,
you know, to put in some of this technology, much less maintain it, is a heavy lift and a tough sell for them if they're not sure about a consistent reimbursement coming back. And so that's what we're trying to get at, and that is also the key part of this legislation that is still being worked on.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that may be one of the concerns I have should there be parity in the reimbursement if you're not using an office, mm-hmm. if you're not using reception staff, if you're not using nursing staff, and it's some of the overhead kind of is not actually necessarily part of a visit if somebody's visiting from their home. And I don't know the answer to that question, I'll be perfectly honest with you, but I think that we should think about it. The other thing that I'm concerned about is I'm very aware of hospitals, providers, health plans that have been getting together and working on their own ACOs, accountable care organizations, to do some real serious negotiations around how we provide care and also how we pay for it. And there's a ton of innovation going on in the private sector that I want to be sure we're not going to get in the way of. And to me, this is just really on the cutting edge of where we could be going in terms of healthcare reform, and I want to be sure that we're not going to get in the way of potential innovation. Sometimes we do that at the legislature, and so I just want to be very thoughtful about that. I don't know if you have any response.
Thank you, Representative Halverson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Halverson. I completely agree with you. Don't in any way want to do something that would get in the way of the innovation or the creativity that the plans have do the good work that they do and deliver good plans to people and meeting their needs. The biggest challenge that we're trying to figure out going forward is if this is going to become a reality going into the future, particularly in our rural areas, what is the piece that we're responsible to make sure is there so that the rural areas buy in? That really is the goal of the bill and trying to figure out how that looks going forward.
Thank you, Representative Mack. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Mack, I am definitely intrigued by the concept, and I will apologize up front if I miss this in the testimony or any of your comments. Say, my son was actually lobbying me on Uber, which is a bill coming up shortly, so if I missed it. My question is, all the wonders of technology, huh, folks? Does the provider get paid if there's a provider on the one end of this connection or the computer and a provider on the other end? Both providers get paid under your bill?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. No, that's a great question. I did not cover that. So in the bill, it stipulates there's the distant site and the originating site. So the originating site is where the patient would walk in the doors and get on the screen or whatever the case might be, and then communicate with the distant site where the specialist is that they're getting access to. And so what this bill does is it provides for some sort of an originating site fee that could be negotiated between the plans and that provider. We don't see that as being a large fee. Again, it would be negotiated, but the point being that they would need some sort of reimbursement in order to just maintain the equipment, keep it up, but the majority of the typical payment would go to the distance provider where that specialist resides.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, so you're not picturing me sitting there with my family doctor speaking to a specialist, because if it's my family doctor, I assume he or she would be reimbursed at their typical rate if they're taking time with me. You're anticipating they'd be sitting there with some technician or something like that, or what does this look like in the real world?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. In terms of what this looks like on the ground, I'll maybe defer to Mr. Anderson, and maybe Ms. Kmit also wants to weigh in terms of how the plans, because as I said, there is payment for telemedicine now, so there is precedent for this, but I'll default to them on how it actually works in reality.
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins. Typically right now it's obviously going to depend a lot on the service. So if you have a telestroke case, so a patient comes into a small hospital with stroke-like symptoms, the provider physician there, usually in the emergency room, will connect with the distant site specialist provider. That specialist will provide instruction and consultation around how to care for that patient and provide whatever medication is necessary or order a transport or what have you. The distant site provider gets paid for that specialty care that they provide. The on-site or originating site provider would only get paid for whatever services that provider actually delivered. So if they had to bandage a wound because the person fell when they had a stroke, that would be a reimbursable service that's not related necessarily to the telemedicine. So they would only be paid for the services that they directly provide. Many providers do sit with the patient during the consultation in order to be able to do the care management that's going to follow up after the specialist, but in those cases they do not get paid for their professional service.
Representative Atkins.
And Mr. Chair, and that to that point, my final comment then, and I appreciate the efforts that both sides have made and that Representative Mack has made. I just, when we see the final product, I'm going to be looking to see that it is tightly wrapped. So that it's not a question, you know, where we come back a year from now and we actually see that costs have gone up because both ends are charging for a service that normally would have been inconvenient for me, mind you, to get in my car and drive. I'm just afraid that we're potentially, if it's not drafted well, we're going to see something that actually increases costs rather than decreases. My final question, I guess, is and maybe somebody's got the data on what we've got 22 other states that have done this. Because I think all 50 states have done some version of telemedicine, as I understand it. 22 have done a bill like this, Representative Mack?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins. I cannot say with certainty that 22 other states have done this bill. I believe, actually, Mr. Anderson and I were just talking about this earlier today. And so, again, I will have him. I don't know if he was able to get the answer that we just talked about an hour ago around this very thing. But if I could have Mr. Anderson speak to that point, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, there are actually many states that don't have any parity legislation at all. So those states, it's still totally between providers and plans as to what telemedicine services are covered or not covered, how they're paid, where they exist, where they don't. The 22 states that have passed what we refer to as parity laws have some version of statutory requirement that plans cover and pay for telemedicine. One of the questions that came up with our meeting with the plans at 2 o'clock is whether those laws require payment at the same rate, the language that we have in this bill. And in the brief time between that meeting and this meeting, the research that I was able to do, which is not extensive, and I don't want to say that it's by any means complete, but from the Center for Connected Health Policy, state telehealth policies and reimbursement schedules report from September 2014, quote, some private payer laws require that the reimbursement amount for a telehealth delivered service be equal to the amount that would have been reimbursed had the same service been delivered in person. So that aspect of the law, at least according to this report, and I got to go back and find out which states those are and do all that, that aspect of the law is included in some of the parity laws. I'm not going to say all 22, and I don't want to be held to that, but that some of the parity laws do require payment at the same level. With respect to the originating site fee, that is something, again, that's often negotiated between plans and providers in Minnesota today as well as in other states. Medicare is the biggest example. Medicare does pay an originating site fee as part of the Medicare program for telemedicine.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you. And thank you.
Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, just Representative Mack, thank you for bringing this bill up. I think it's a great conversation. You mentioned rural areas many times, and I think I know the answer, but I want to make sure we have varying degrees of broadband connections out there. So is this getting ahead of those areas at all? Is it going to give an advantage or a disadvantage to someone that may or may not have the access? Maybe there's no ramifications, but I just want to make sure.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's an excellent point. Most telemedicine is very difficult, if not impossible, to provide without broadband. And so the Minnesota Hospital Association also supports extending broadband into rural communities, including what is referred to as last mile access so that it gets to the patient's home or nursing home or what have you. So that is an existing limiting factor on the reach of telemedicine. We believe that while this law will be helpful and may provide maybe additional support for extending broadband, we think that it will still allow, where there is broadband, to be increased access. But that ability to get the signal to a particular location is going to be a limiting factor.
Representative Cruzio.
And thank you for that, Mr. Anderson. So just to follow up, so no, if Community A has strong broadband and Community B does not, there's no advantage or disadvantage. It's just the limitations going to be on the broadband, not this regulation.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, that is true, with the exception that either of those communities, if one has broadband and one doesn't, the one with broadband still has to have a provider or someone that wants to be able to have the equipment and technology to do the service. The location that doesn't have broadband obviously is going to have a much harder time justifying those investments. But when they get broadband, there would be nothing that would prevent them from being able to have those services.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, just following up on Representative Kreisch's line of discussion there, is it fair to say that a wireless connection, particularly the last mile, would not have the speed, capacity, or security to provide the kind of broadband necessary for telemedicine at this time? It would need to be a hard line wire to the site.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's going to depend on the telemedicine service. So this simple example of teledermatology, a lot of dermatologists will allow a patient to take a photo of the mole or whatever they want examined and send it to them through their phone. Wireless technology is going to be perfectly suitable for that, with or without landlines. So that kind of telemedicine can happen and does happen. Other telemedicine, where you're talking about tele-ER or telestroke, where you have multiple cameras controlled at a remote location, video, audio equipment, all of those kind of things, as well as direct access to decision support tools and those kind of things, you're going to need a broadband, or when we get wireless technology, that has a lot more oomph to it than it does now,
right,
in order to be able
Thank
to
you,
have
Mr.
those
Anderson.
Kind of services.
Thank you. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bentley Graves from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just very, very quickly, I want to echo what Ms. Kmit said about working with the hospitals, working with Representative Mack to get a bill that works well for everyone. We as the Chamber of Commerce, of course, look at healthcare policy with a very close eye to cost. There are some things in this bill that do worry us some, in particular the originating site fee, but that is something that has been and I think probably will continue to be a topic of conversation both between the plans and the hospitals and Representative Mack and us. And we want to make sure that we have a bill that puts us on a path to utilization of telemedicine in a way that works both for providers but also for patients and payers in a way that charts us into the future to make sure that telemedicine is a vital part of our healthcare system. And we're committed to keeping that conversation going and certainly appreciate all the work that's been done and appreciate the opportunity to just kind of raise that issue for you this afternoon. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody coming down. Representative Mack, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the time. I appreciate the conversation, and you have my commitment to continue to work on this bill and get at any of the existing issues. But I think the important thing is to just keep in mind what the core goal is here, and that is to leverage what technology can offer us to further our healthcare goals and make sure that no matter where you live in the state, you have access to the same quality of care. So with that, I appreciate the support of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Mack. And again, on behalf of the committee, thank you to Ms. Kmit, Mr. Anderson, and all the other people that are working on this ongoing Close to Peace in the Valley work in progress. We appreciate it. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1246, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Finance. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Mack and members.
Thank you,
Representative Sanders.
You're sitting there looking like you want to do a bill. Why don't we go ahead and take yours, because I think yours will be relatively quick. Representative Sanders will go ahead and move House File 1135. I believe this goes to the General Register.
Sounds good to me, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1135 would put in place a model act to regulate guaranteed asset protection waivers, or GAP waivers. The intent of this legislation is to put in place a regulatory framework for this product where there currently are none. And this would require certain consumer protections as well. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Cassidy, Mr. Thrain here as well to briefly walk through the bill and answer any questions as well.
Representative Sanders, I have an A1 amendment here. Is that your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to offer that now, or do you want to have testifiers go first? It's your preference.
I'll go ahead and move the A1, Mr. Chair, to put the bill in the shape that I'd like.
Representative Sanders moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Sanders, for bringing these two fine gentlemen. They're among our two favorite testifiers ever, known for their wit and brevity. We like them.
I do my best, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Cassidy.
Chairman,
please proceed.
Paul Cassidy with the law firm of Stensard Leonard Street, representing an association called Guaranteed Asset Protection Alliance that's bringing this bill before you today. I'll just add a few comments and hand this off to Mr. Thrain to go through the bill and the A1 amendment. But as Representative Sanders said, this bill is intended to put in place regulations and consumer protections where none exist at the moment. Some financial institutions already offer this product in the state of Minnesota. It's being offered in 47 other states around the country. It's also regulated in some other states including Washington, Michigan, Nebraska, North Carolina, and Texas. In other states, it's also under consideration in 2015. With that, Mr. Chairman, one other thing I'd like to point out that I think gets lost on this bill is that it does not just apply to new vehicle or new car purchases. It applies to both new and used motor vehicle purchases, including new and used cars, boats, RVs, motorcycles, all-terrain vehicles, etc. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll hand this off to Mr. Thrain, and he can walk through the bill briefly and the A1 amendment.
Mr. Cassidy, thank you. Mr. Thrain, always welcome. Please proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Let me just briefly walk through the bill, and I highlight a few key points here, I think, that are the sort of the core points of the bill. Let me first note in Section 1, Paragraph B, this is an exemption from the insurance law, and the reason that's appropriate here is because a guaranteed asset waiver is a two-party contract. It's not a third-party contract. There's not a third party guaranteeing the performance of another. This is simply a transaction between a lender and a borrower. Hence, the insurance laws respects the solvency requirements are really not applicable in this transaction, and that's why that's appropriate. In addition, as I walk through the bill, there's a number of consumer protections here that are appropriate to this kind of a transaction that don't exist in the insurance law. So we think this is a superior form of regulation. Let me just walk through then some of the key consumer protections. The definitions, I think, are all fairly self-evident. Let me just sort of point out one definition to you. The free look period, that's 30 days, and as you see in later in the bill, that provides the opportunity for a consumer to walk away from the transactions, no questions asked, with a full refund of their money. The other key contractual, but the points are in Section 4, a number of key points, and I would highlight for you the insurance requirement. This requires that a seller of guaranteed asset contracts purchase insurance to guarantee their performance under the contracts. There's times that when a retail seller of these contracts, to assure that they have the financial ability to perform their obligations, that retail seller is obligated to buy a policy of insurance to guarantee those options. A number of other key points, Subdivision 6, the extension of credit, the terms of the credit, or the term of the motor vehicle cannot be conditioned on the purchase of a GAP waiver. A lender or a retail seller cannot say you have to buy the GAP waiver to buy the car or get the lending, which is a key consumer protection. I would then go through the disclosures a number of key disclosures that must be made to the consumer. I think I won't read them to you, but they certainly are more disclosures than are required today by law, dealing with return of the return premium, the extension of credit, and so forth. And finally, then, we deal with the refund provisions. Refund provisions during the refree look period, and also refund provisions during a period if a contract is cancelable after the free look period. With that, Mr. Chairman and Representative Sanders, I'm happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Therrien and Mr. Cassidy. Mr. Brickwitty, do you want to come down?
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty from the Commerce Department. Just very quickly, I want to thank Representative Sanders. The Commerce Department does have a couple of reservations on the bill. I'll highlight two of them, but we're in conversations with Mr. Cassidy, Mr. Therrien, Representative Sanders, and are moving in the right direction, so appreciate that work.
Mr. Brickwitty, I hate to interrupt you, but that's what we always like to hear, so thank you for working that. Thank you, Mr. Cassidy and Representative Sanders, Mr. Therrien. We always appreciate moving towards the elusive peace in the valley.
Mr. Chairman, 2 points. The Commerce Department does view this product as an insurance product. So as we move forward, we're coding this outside of the insurance statute. So one thing that we do want to make clear is what the department's regulatory authority is over these types of products and transactions, just to make sure both to businesses and to consumers what the rules of the road will be. And then second, I think this is the issue that I think is of significant concern, and I think we're headed towards resolving it, is I think in the walkthrough in the bill with the protection that this could not be contingent, the purchase of the GAP product could not be contingent on obtaining credit, I think is clear in the bill. But what's not clear is on the back end, if the cancellation of the GAP product, which is available to the consumer both inside and potentially outside of the free look period, whether or not that would also have an impact on the loan being called. And so we'd like to clarify that to make sure that consumers understand that this is a voluntary product and what it is that they're truly purchasing and what their ability is once the transaction is completed. So we'll be working on that going forward. And thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Members, any questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to anybody, I'm still not clear on why this is not insurance. Mr. Therrien, maybe, as I understand it, a bad event happens, you pay. That, to me, sounds like it has all the hallmarks of insurance. Why is it not insurance?
Mr. Therrien.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, there are differing positions of that by the Department of Commerce over time, and states have reached different positions as to whether or not a particular transaction is insurance. As you're aware, Minnesota's definition of insurance is incredibly broad, and it can apply to any number of transactions. I think there's a great argument here that this is insurance. We think there's an argument that it isn't. We think we should resolve that ambiguity in favor of a set piece and series of regulations that's applicable to this particular product. So,
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, and I thank you. Regardless of how it's resolved, the proponents of the bill do not object to having Commerce oversee this product, correct?
Mr. Therrien?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no. In fact, by codifying this in Chapter 59B, this is among the duties and responsibilities entrusted to the commissioner under Chapter 45, and the commissioner would have full investigatory and discipline authority under Section 45.027.
And, Mr. Chair,
Representative,
final question, I think, is sell me on this. Do the math for me. Why would it be cost-effective for me to purchase this?
Mr. Cassidy, Mr. Therrien, Representative Sanders?
The transaction at play here is if I purchase a new car, I'm just giving you an example. I drive off the lot. My car is depreciated more than my loan value for a period of time, and if my car is a total loss, I'll end up owing money to the lender, more money to the lender than I will receive in the proceeds of my insurance. And this contract allows the consumer to fill that gap, and they might not otherwise be able to obtain the vehicle at a financing level that provides more equity in the vehicle at the time of purchase, number one. Or number two, they may not have the ability to fund the gap at the time of a total loss. And so this contract is purchased by consumers in need of that kind of a service.
Representative Atkins.
And thank you, and I appreciate the first part of the question got answered very well. Can you do the math for me? Give me some real numbers and how often this sort of event occurs.
So if I buy a $50,000 car and I don't have any money, I borrow $50,000, I drive off the lot, that car's worth $45,000, so that gap amount would be $5,000. Is that,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, that's the intention of this. That's the concept, yes. With respect to specific premium calculations and specific loss information, Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, I don't have that information. I'd be happy to provide it, however.
Do you have,
Representative Atkins,
Mr. Chairman, do you have a client here with you today?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, we do not. Our client was called to Oregon.
Well, we can wait. No, but if you could, I would be interested in seeing the actual, because my sense is that this may be a very expensive product for a situation that seldom arises, and that's why I'm just curious to see. I mean, if it that doesn't mean that people can't buy it. I'm not necessarily saying that it shouldn't be a legal product to buy, but if it's the kind of thing that you pay $1,000 and the likely, you know, $1,000 over the course of time, and the likelihood of it happening is 1 in 5,000 or 1 in 3,000. I just kind of like to know what the actual numbers are. What's the risk? What's the cost? And then we can go from there.
Representative Atkins, maybe you and I should go out to the parking area and pick up a, I don't know, Tesla or something like that. Take it out for a drive and see what happens.
I'm in.
Mr. Thrain?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, I'm happy to provide that information.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thrain. Representative Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple questions. One is, don't people still make down payments when they buy new cars?
Mr. Chairman, Cassidy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dent, of course they do, but a lot of folks don't. And when you compound that problem with driving either a new or used vehicle off a lot and it automatically depreciates, it takes quite a while for some people to get back to where they're actually building equity back into their car.
Okay, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, yeah, it kind of makes sense, but at the same time, I feel like I'm checking out and buying a set of speakers at Best Buy, and they're trying to tell me for $49 I can have, you know, an extended warranty on these. And I know it's not an extended warranty, but I feel like at the time of purchase, if I'm doing this, I'm going to be in an awkward situation. And if I think I'm in a situation where there's potential loss because I'm exposing myself financially, I might not make the same decision that if I wasn't in that situation. So to me, it's an issue of cost. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm buying $5,000, let's use the $50,000 car, $5,000 worth of coverage for what might be less than 10 months, maybe, considering what I'm paying per month. Mm-hmm. If that's going to cost me $1,000, I mean, that's a pretty high cost for that type of coverage. So I guess I have some leeriness on what the benefit is, you know, what the charts would look like, and actually how consumers ultimately are going to benefit from this, as well as the lending institutions who are going to, in some ways, cover their losses. Right. Because ultimately, if they can't recover the cost, they're going to sue people, and if they can't recover it from the lawsuit, ultimately they lose the money.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, and a little bit to Representative Atkins' points as well. This bill isn't creating new products. These products already exist. They're already being sold. Banks, credit unions, some insurance companies already sell these types of products. This bill is just simply putting in some consumer protections, as well as, you know, kind of putting some maybe more statutory guidelines or clarification into statute. So I think the conversation, and we'll be happy to try and get you some of that information, but I think the conversation is more about, you know, what consumer protections are there and how are these products working versus does the bill create the products or not, because they're already out there being used and being sold.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody. Representative Sanders, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good bill. Please vote for it.
That's the kind of final word we like. Representative Sanders renews his motion that House File 1135, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Sanders. Representative Swidzinski.
Which bill might this be?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swidzinski, go ahead and move House File 1783.
Yes, I move House File 1783 before the Commerce Committee.
And Representative Swidzinski,
General Register.
Okay, Representative Swidzinski, I believe this is going to the General Register.
Yes, to the General Register, sir.
So, thank you, Representative Swidzinski. Please proceed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 1783 is a bill that outlines insurance responsibilities for transportation network companies that provide ride sharing for a fee. It is my belief that TNCs are going to play a growing role in our transportation future. Using and filling capacity in privately owned automobiles lessens congestion and allows a quick and direct option for those in need of a ride. The combination of increased popularity and the unique product delivery innovation has left our state laws playing catch-up to market forces. Currently, the largest of our cities in the first class have local ordinances governing these TNCs, but with statewide expansion and use around the corner, we as state legislators must act to ensure both entrepreneurs and riders are properly covered. The bill lays a framework of required coverage for those participating in a TNC in three specific phases. The first phase is when the app is on, while the entrepreneur is looking for customers to serve. The second phase is when a TNC driver is engaged in the app and actually on their way to pick up a specific customer. And the third phase is when a customer is in the car en route to the desired destination. After the customer is dropped off at the app, they can either go back into the search mode, turn the app off, and at that point in time, they would not be covered. They'd be once the app is off, they would be covered by their personal insurance. The bill is drafted as required coverage for $1.5 million across these three phases. The reason why we came up with $1.5 million is because it's a close proximity to where limos are placed in statute, and that was passed last year. I have Commerce Commissioner Rothman and Bob Johnson here to testify, and I want to just thank you very much. We have an amendment.
Swidzinski, do you want to go ahead and offer the A4 amendment?
Sure. I move the A4 amendment and would appreciate your
vote. Why don't you do just a quick explanation of this amendment for members?
All right. So the A4 amendment, if you go to, let me pull up my bill here so I've got it. Page 1, line 12, that is, so after compensation, we're going to put primarily using an online. So this was brought forth as kind of a technical amendment because of the usage in the primary, you know, we're talking about TNCs. The primary spot where they get their ridership is from an online source. And some of the other folks within the taxi industry felt that they potentially have a portion of their riderships are gotten this way, but not a primary mode. Mostly they use a dispatcher. And so this would kind of really focus in a little bit. And then the other portion is moving from three phases of the insurance, is moving it from $1.5 million to the $1 million mark. This is in reaction to some of the testimony that we heard over in the Senate and trying to get things a little closer to the product that they produced over there. And I'd appreciate your vote.
Thank you, Representative Swidzinski. We'll go ahead and vote on the A4 amendment. Those in favor of the adoption of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Swidzinski. Commissioner Rothman, welcome back to the committee. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for this opportunity to discuss this important bill. It's great to be here on this beautiful St. Patrick's Day. I also want to thank Representative Swidzinski as well as the bipartisan group of legislators who are co-authoring the bill and bringing this bill forward. As Commissioner, the Department fully supports House File 1783. This bill addresses big insurance gaps and protects drivers and families in Minnesota from loss resulting from an accident. You know, TNCs are an important, innovative business, entrepreneurial. They provide consumers with good, new transportation options and businesses, business and job opportunities for many in Minnesota. So we very much encourage this new business development. It's important to have these transportation options available to our consumers and to Minnesotans. But at the same time, as the business grows, however, the department has highlighted significant questions regarding big gaps in insurance coverage that place drivers, passengers, and even members of the general public at potential risk. Now, this first came to my attention last spring. I heard a story about a young girl in San Francisco. The event happened on New Year's Eve in 2013. I believe her name is Sophia Liu, and her mother and brother were walking across the street and got hit by a TNC driver, striking and killing her and injuring the others in the family. The story is ongoing, even as of today, as far as I understand, as the child's family is now engaged in legal disputes and issues over damages because there's no clarity, or there wasn't at the time. In other words, the existence of an insurance gap has placed a tremendous burden on that family. Simply put, when I heard the story, I felt that this should not happen in our state. Minnesota families shouldn't face this burden. So last May, I issued a consumer alert offering tips to drivers and riders, pointing out the gap in insurance and making sure that folks looked at their auto insurance policies and understood the exclusions that are in there to make sure that they understand and have a discussion with the TNC companies to cover the gaps that are there. So the department's interest is simply that drivers, passengers, and the public are properly covered in the event of the accident. Adequate insurance coverage must be in place so that in the event of an accident, it is clear who bears the risk of loss. Last December, and I think members have a copy of the letter, or if not, we can get it there, get it to you folks. I sent a letter to you, Mr. Chair, and the other leaders of the Commerce Committees in both chambers, highlighting this issue and suggesting that that it be addressed so that Minnesotans tackle the issue this legislative session. Simply put, we cannot have in Minnesota a similar situation to what happened in California with that young family. And House File 1783 clarifies the insurance requirements for companies operating in Minnesota, and the bill provides drivers, passengers,
Mr. Oh, that was a good one.
On behalf of the committee, we apologize.
No, you know, I was just...
That's a dollar in the bucket.
Mr. Chairman and to the Commissioner, I love this bill, and I appreciate the department getting on board. It's the song is Don't Stop Believing. So thank you.
You and me.
I can't believe I just did that.
Representative Davis, I was going to get up and dance. It's one of my favorite songs in high school.
We'll just let this go. Mr. Commissioner, thank please you, proceed.
No problem. So now, where was I?
Don't stop believing.
I think you were saying it's a lonely world, but that's what I remember hearing.
Okay, we should probably... Maybe we should have a song and dance. In any event, we fully support the bill. House File 1783 does address some of these issues. I know there's been the amendment, and there were discussions about limits and all that, but the bottom line is that HF 1783 appropriately balances putting responsible insurance coverage in place so that we can have the risk of these events covered. So in any event, I just want to thank you for the opportunity, and happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Commissioner, thank you very much. You're always welcome here. Mr. Johnson? If so, please keep it to yourself.
I will. Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And I have to first acknowledge to Representative Atkins, my son was bugging me too just a couple minutes ago on this bill.
We'll see if they were on the same side of the issue here.
So Anyway, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm pleased to be here today and join Commissioner Rothman in supporting House File 1783. So why is this bill here? And frankly, half of our nation's commerce commissioners have to date issued consumer advisories, consumer alerts, just as Commissioner Rothman did, warning consumers in their state about an insurance coverage gap. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners has similarly issued a warning. So this is a real problem. It's a real issue. And the reason for the gap, and I'll just give you one phrase, and I think you'll understand this well. What we're dealing with here is the commercial use of a personal asset. That's what the issue is of the day, commercial use of a personal asset. And as this committee knows full well, we have personal auto policies. We have a homeowner's policy. Those are personal assets. If any of us use those assets for a commercial business purpose, those policies do not supply coverage. So every one of you here can go home and pull out your auto policy, the paper or electronically, and you will find in it a livery exclusion, L-I-V-E-R-Y. That is the exclusion for the commercial use of your car. And we do that because we have commercial auto policies and a commercial auto market fully developed. It's there for commercial business use of vehicles and the personal auto pool. So we keep the pool separate because it's really not fair to consumers that risk of commercial car use get put in their pool. So we keep the pool separate. And so that's the rationale and the reasons why we have a gap, why it needs to be addressed. States are acting coast to coast in dealing with this gap. So Colorado, Kentucky, Washington, D.C., Illinois, California, Virginia, and the list will keep growing. This bill parallels, not entirely, but now with the amendment, it's getting a lot closer, parallels to what states are doing. So we need to eliminate the gap, and we need to establish clear rules in terms of liabilities and when they attach, when they don't, who's responsible, who's not. You have in your packet, and I will not go through it, but I would urge you, if you get a moment, we did want the committee members to see today if a consumer is engaged in this activity and involved in an accident, the red boxes would describe the processes that a consumer is going to have to go through to process their claim. And the green boxes would describe the process if House File 1783 is enacted. And again, the purpose of that, there's ambiguity and there's loops in the process of sorting through coverages that this legislation addresses. And the states that are acting on it, it addresses those ambiguities. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is a bill that with the amendment is fitting in. I could point out where there's differences. There are some differences from this legislation to what some of the other states have acted on to date, primarily in that phase one. And the phase one is app on. Nobody's in the car. You're looking for business. App on, looking for business. That's the one phase. Other than that, the bill, as it's been amended now by Representative Fedzinski and the $1 million, tracks with what the states that have active have passed. And the second area, Mr. Chairman, I would just mention is this collision and comprehensive coverage. The way House File 1783 is drafted and before the committee, it mandates collision and comp if the consumer has chosen to buy that coverage on their car. So all of us today, we have the choice of whether we want to buy that coverage. It's not mandated by state law. If the consumer has chosen that coverage, then House File 1783 requires that that be a coverage that's supplied by either the TNC or the driver. And the bill does, Mr. Chairman, keep open the prospects of the market developing different than it is today, and it actually is starting to develop differently. Companies are coming out with some products that they're offering to consumers to pick up some of the coverage, but that doesn't in and of itself address the coverage gap that we're dealing with right now. So that, Mr. Chairman, then lastly, I do want to comment, because it did come up in the Senate hearing, there is a question about whether or not House File 1783, as it's drafted, prohibits the use of an excess or surplus lines company. And some of you, it's an area of the statutes that's under this committee's jurisdiction. It doesn't come here too often. It's found in the statute section 608.201 and some sections around that. House File 1783 does not prohibit going to excess surplus lines carrier. It puts this coverage in the statute that if you meet the conditions, so we've had long-standing Minnesota law, to the conditions that have to be met, at which point you can go to the excess surplus lines carriers. And we think those conditions are important because that's a different market. In that market, for instance, there's no guarantee fund coverage. The regulations of the claims practices is decidedly different. Less the financial safeguards governing the companies are decidedly different and lower, and deliberately to have that kind of a relief valve in the market. So I represent companies that sell excess surplus lines. You generally see it more in kind of the specialized commercial area, not in the personal lines. So the bill does not prohibit it. Having said that, and if the coverage meets those thresholds, then the coverage can go to the excess surplus lines. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we think it is a responsible bill. It deals with the coverage gap. It draws the lines clearly that we need to have drawn. It recognizes the ability of the market to develop going forward, and I believe it positions Minnesota, frankly, not exactly, but pretty closely with where the states are acting to similarly address the coverage gap. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you very much. You know, you think you're safe in the basement with a cell phone. Mine doesn't work down here, and it was off. But I just love that song. I would just like to thank the gentleman from Lyon, and especially thank Commissioner Rothman, as I did a little bit before here. But when Commissioner Rothman saw the need here, he jumped all over it. And this is a big deal. This could really put some people's financial futures or ruin people's financial futures. So thank you to the Commissioner and the Federation and the gentleman from Lyon for working on this important issue. And I think this bill takes care of the hole that we have there.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is for Mr. Johnson or for the Commissioner. Currently, a lot of folks that go off to college, they have to hitch a ride with somebody. So are you saying under current law, those folks that are hitching a ride with somebody to get a ride home, are they violating state law, and are they then not going to be able to use their insurance if they're driving somebody home from college and they get paid for gas? And how is that different from an Uber driver who is offering their services that way? Can you give me an idea of how is that different?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, at least as I understand if I understand how you're describing that kind of an occasional, you're not in the business of transporting people. This is a formal commercial business. And so that'd be the difference of that. And our state law, I don't have the statutes in front of me, our state law recognizes that there's some carpooling and car sharing that are recognized in law that are not business and they're covered under the personal auto policies. So at least as you described that, in my opinion, in my opinion, I don't believe that that's going to trigger, and it's not comparable to a formal business operation that where you make a formal decision to sign up. The TNC actually supplies, as I understand it, a device. So you probably have two devices, your own and theirs, and you sign on. It's a formal procedure to turn it on, to engage in the network, and you're good to go for business, and you make commitments to take rides as they come up. So it's, in my opinion, it's a formal business arrangement, and that distinguishes it from the occasional ride sharing, ride use, carpooling, which the state law does not term a business, and those are covered under personal auto policies.
Representative Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, so a mom that is providing the carpooling services for all the neighborhood kids and does it every single day for the entire school year, or a coworker that does it for one of their coworkers and they drive for them every single day for the entire year, is this going to apply to them, or how does that work?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, I mean, this bill actually more formally defines the service that's covered by it. And so what you're describing would, as you look in the definition section, the requirement here formally kicks into what a TNC is defined, and that's not what you just described. So in other words, unless you're within this definitional box, you are not subject to the insurance requirements of this.
Representative Anderson.
And, Mr. Chair, I promise my last question. So then are you going to be coming down the road then asking that we go take the next step for those individuals that are offering the carpooling to the neighborhood kids or to the co-worker or something to that effect?
Yeah. Mr. Johnson.
Representative Anderson, I sincerely don't believe that this has developed and exploded globally in the last 3 years. The kinds of activities and things that you're describing have been around for many decades, and I've never had any discussions or issues with my membership as to any concerns that's, you know, if you formally get in a commercial business where you're transporting people for hire and you're engaged in a business, then you ought to be buying a commercial auto policy. And if you're not, you don't have to do that. So, no, I don't foresee any interest on our industry's part in taking steps that would, you know, try to regulate or put in place coverage requirements for that kind of situation.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative, good questions. Representative Lunan, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to point to Representative Anderson, as Mr. Johnson's right, the delivery exclusion says delivery for a fee. And the for a fee implies that there's money you're going to put in your pocket that exceeds what your expenditure is. So carpooling, whether it's kids or it's neighbors or co-workers, and you're getting paid from them, that's not the issue. It becomes an issue when the amount you're paid exceeds what your expenses are, and now you are walking away with a fee. So the for the fee is the trigger. That's what constitutes it being a commercial experience, is that threshold.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions on how this would work. So if you were going to be a driver for one of these companies, transportation network companies, and you were going to do it part-time, maybe you were a student or maybe you had, you know, another job that you worked, would you get this insurance as an addendum or addition to your personal policy, or would they have to be completely separate policies? And I was looking through that, you know, the transportation network company would have to verify that your coverage is intact under this. So I guess I don't know what the relationship is between the people who drive. Are they generally independent contractors? Are they considered employees of the TNCs?
Representative Swedzinski or Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lewin, I'm certain that they're not employees. They're independent contractors. And it's two separate columns. So in other words, we're mandated under current Minnesota law as individuals having cars and driving them personally, we're required to have insurance. And then the legislature spells out what those coverages are. Limousines in Minnesota are licensed, and last year this legislature passed a requirement that they have to have $1.5 million in liability coverage. The cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul have passed, as Representative Swedzinski said, their own ordinances dealing with TNCs, and those companies have to file their coverages with the city that they meet the city's requirements. So this is not dissimilar to what we do in other areas of commercial activity, but they're two separate columns. So in other words, the personal auto policy is as it is. If you're engaged in this defined activity of a transportation network company, then the way it's drafted, either the TNC or you, the individual, have to meet these coverage requirements. I think it's fair to say, at least to date, the way this has evolved in the states that have passed this, the TNC is supplying the coverage. I mean, these are major, major corporations of significant size that have the resources and the sophistication to structure the risks, and it's a public record, so one of the largest ones uses a Bermuda offshore company. It's an excess surplus lines company, and that's totally legal to do, and large corporations often do use Bermuda offshore companies or Vermont captives to manage their risk. So I think businesses are accustomed to dealing with these kinds of insurance requirements, and they're doing it today. And as I indicated, they've already publicly testified that they're supplying the $1 million coverage in phase 2 and 3. So that's already happening. the debate really, I think, today, as we speak, comes down to phase one, Appon, looking for a customer and how much coverage should be required for.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I think that's what I'm trying to grapple with, because we know we have a fair number of drivers just on the road every day without insurance. And so, I mean, is that going to be part of this process, too, that you're going to ascertain that these part-time drivers have a personal policy of coverage? Because, you know, if they're sometimes they're on and sometimes they're not, I could foresee a problem where there could be some dispute that develops as to whether or not they were on the clock driving for Uber or Lyft versus not. And I'm just wondering how that would be resolved.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Johnson.
I'm not going to speak for them.
Mr. Johnson, we've got almost everybody in the committee has questions, and we have more testifiers. So if I could ask you to shorten them up, I'd appreciate it.
Well, actually, then maybe I should just not answer that and have the representatives of Uber answer your question, kind of their business, how it attaches, when it attaches, and how they differentiate that.
Representative Lewis.
Fine. Thank you.
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question actually follows Representative Loon's question quite well. I look at the black and white chart, and even with the amendment, the phase or period one coverage still seems very expensive comparatively looking at the other states. Can you explain to me why that is? Did I miss something? I'm not understanding that.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, just as Representative Svedinsky said, and this bill came out of meetings with Commissioner Rothman and looking what states were doing. We looked at what this legislature passed last year for limos, and it's a 2014 law, and that's transporting people for money, and that was a $1.5 million coverage. The taxi cabs, and they're here, can testify for themselves, but they testified yesterday that most of the major cab companies in Minneapolis are at $1.5 or $2 million, although the city ordinance is lower than that. So that's not what the city ordinance requires. So that's really that's how that number was put in, but it's been lowered to the million now. And the million, as you can see on your chart in front of you, other than the first column, lines up identically with the other states. And I think the issue is this. If you're in the business of transporting, which starts when you flip on the app, the risk is there at that moment. And frankly, that was the situation that Commissioner Rothman talked about at an intersection in San Francisco with the app on. If I'm wrong on this, I'll be corrected, but the app on, nobody in the car. And if you hit somebody and there's no coverage under your personal auto policy, is 50 and 100 enough for that individual or family that's hurt and killed in that instance? And this is the coverage pool that individual is going to look to. So, but I think that's an issue for this committee and the legislature to decide what do you think is the best dollar amount of coverage and protection in that box.
Representative Swedzinski.
And Mr. Chair, members, and I think, you know, when you're looking at that number beyond what Mr. Johnson talked about, kind of the correlation between what's already existing in law for other folks that are engaged in a commercial activity, but also, you know, what is the activity that's going on in that first phase? And I've got a news article from the Sacramento Bee. I don't know if that was shared or not with the committee, and I can make copies of it, too, but it was their opinion that first phase is also one of the most dangerous because of the correspondence that's going on while that app is on, you know, because of the distracted potential that's going on with texting back and forth with you or looking at the phone ready to push or ready to potentially do some conversing. And so, you know, while the argument can be made that while some folks may be just sitting in a coffee shop waiting, you know, we don't know where those folks are at, if they're parked along the side of the road or they're in route or if they're just kind of, and so I think that's why there is some, you know, where those, you know, what other states have done in the past, but why we're sitting where we're at. And I think that's that is a number that we can discuss and debate right here. And I appreciate your concern on that portion.
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, I would like more conversation on that because it seems out of line with what the other states are doing. And I don't want to be an outlier. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hurt businesses in our state, you know, because of this. So I would like to talk more about it. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This has been kind of a fun committee this year. We've got all the fancy beer and liquor issues, and then the telemedicine, and now Uber and Lyft. I mean, I'm
Representative Lilly.
We're pretty hip.
What do you mean by this year?
Well, I think our past year wasn't quite as exciting.
Representative Atkins, so, I wouldn't take that.
So it's pretty fun. So it's kind of exciting to be on the cutting edge of issues. So Representative Swinsky, I just can't say it.
The gentleman from Lyon.
I always think of Schwann's. So I've just a couple questions and concerns. I'm curious what taxis kind of what do they pay for this kind of insurance? So that would be one question. And the other one, for the last couple of years, I have heard, we don't want to be the highest in the nation. We've kind of heard that one a little bit. I don't know from who or what, but it seems like this, when I look at it, I'm just curious if we could roll it back to the million. Sure. And maybe there's a good reason and viable reason, but it just I appreciate Mr. Johnson's concern about the gap and others, you know, and the Commissioner Rothman's testimony as far as the need for the gap coverage and the concern. I get that. I just hate to see us be the highest in the nation. Sure. And to not be progressive and allow this opportunity for these businesses to thrive and grow in Minnesota.
Representative Lilly, good question. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, I believe that was Majority Leader Bach that said that. I think it was at the chamber dinner about 2 years ago, that he said that if we're in the top five of any sector of tax, I think that's a bad thing, and didn't carry through to the end of session. You know, looking at from the limos, I do believe that the coverage changes depending on what style of a taxi they are. If they're an independent contractor, which is a very few, if they're an individual that owns the taxi and that's what they're doing, I believe it's like 100, 300. I think there might be someone from the taxi organization here. But a vast majority are essentially, whether they be employees or part of a large tax organization, a lot of those folks are in the $1.5 to $2 million coverage, depending on how large they are. So, you know, there is a sliver of them that are at that lower range, but most of them are probably higher than what we're at.
Representative Lilly, you follow up?
I'll avoid the first tax thing, but we'll.
Okay, sorry.
No, that probably wasn't the best example, the taxi drivers, because, you know, they're probably more professional drivers, if you will, and bought under an umbrella of coverage. But it just seems, I mean, I'm concerned about mm-hmm. just being the highest in the nation. And
sure.
I think this is something that really a lot of people like and want to try to use, and I just am concerned that we potentially could drive it out of use or,
sure.
Make it unviable. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. And I know that we have more people that want to come down and testify, but young lady, if you want to go ahead, you've been sitting up there for a while, I apologize, but welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Roman, and I am a sophomore at the University of St. Thomas. I'm studying actuarial science, and I have actually recently started an insurance academic fraternity at St. Thomas, so I'm a little bit more involved in the industry as a normal college sophomore might be. But I'm here today to speak with you about the perspective of the younger generation of TNC users. For many college students like myself, an idea of a quick, convenient, and relatively cheap method of transportation is very appealing. I have always been hesitant to use a service, however, because I see several risks that need to be covered. I have only used Uber once before with a friend of mine that uses a service quite often. Right away, it seemed unsafe to me because the drivers use their cell phones to get in contact with their clients, receive payment, and other company operations. I hear reports time and time again that cell phone use while driving puts one at a greater risk of an accident. I am very cautious with my cell phone use while driving, and I absolutely do not feel more safe having an unfamiliar driver drive me around while they're using their cell phones. So as we were driving through rush hour traffic, a few questions came to mind. If there was an accident, how would it be covered? Would the driver's auto insurance be liable to pay for any injuries? Would Uber be the responsible party? Would I have to file a claim with my insurance company? Would I even have coverage for this? any of these questions were not made clear to me throughout the entire process of using the service. I work part-time in a chiropractic office, and we see a lot of auto accident patients trying to recover from a severe accident, and having to deal with coverage or claim issues can be exhausting and mentally taxing. It would be for the benefit of both the policyholders and the insurance companies to put legislation into place that closes this gap in coverage. As a potential user of TNC services, it would put my mind at rest that in the event of an accident, I would have coverage. Insurance companies are then able to account for the new risk that TNC companies present in the auto insurance market. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Nice job testifying. And Representative Slocum, to this testifier, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm so disappointed that people were texting and driving, because we have a law against that. And I put a bill in this year to ramp that up, to make it a, to include cell phone usage, handheld cell phone usage while driving, that I'd love to get a hearing from in public safety.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. We have a number of questions from members. Representative Atkins is next on the list. Can we...
I'm going to bring us...
Okay. That's what I was just going to suggest. Thank you, Representative Atkins. Thank you very much. Nice job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean?
Yeah, Mr. Johnson, thank you, Mr. Chair, if you could come on back. So I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, God, am I like an outlier here? Because I know that Minneapolis has adopted rules relative to this, which are very different than what's proposed in this bill. It goes around the period one coverage. And you know, I appreciate, you know, what happened to the family in San Francisco. But that was prior to an actual cash transaction taking place. The cash transaction takes place when the passenger gets in the car. So when I think about the issue of, you know, when it does it become moving from your insurance to, you know, the TNC coverage, I think about that. And I bring up Minneapolis because I think there's some issue of local control here in thinking about how local jurisdictions address this particular issue. And then, you know, I think about things in the East Bay area, the informal carpools. I don't know if anyone's been to, you know, Oakland area or East Bay area, that there's actually a spot where you can drive up, and to get over the Bay Bridge, you need 3 people in your car, not 1 or 2, and people actually get into the car, and you drive across the bridge, and you not only save time, you also save money. And we don't have that type of situation in Minneapolis right now, but what if in the future, to get on the fast lane, you were out in Minnetonka and you picked up a couple people to get in your car, to get in the fast lane, so you have an informal agreement about this. And I'm curious about all those types of things. And then, Mr. Johnson, you know, you made the point that these are major companies that are doing this with money in offshore areas, which isn't illegal. And, you know, just for the record, insurance companies are major companies too. And quite frankly, I think that this is, although we talk a lot about safety and the individuals and how we make sure that they have coverage, I think that this is one of those areas where we have two elephants fighting, and ultimately it's the grass that gets hurt. So that's my comments.
Okay.
For now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Is there anybody else that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Mr. Carlson? And
well, I want to discuss the major things. Yep.
And all kinds of stuff. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. Please proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of Uber Technologies, and I've got 3 people with me that would like to provide some testimony, because we do have a lot of, I think, misperception and misinformation to clear up about what's in place in Minneapolis and how this system works. I'm gonna start with Michael White, who's the general manager for Uber Technologies in our region. And we've got 2 drivers that are here that would like to at least share brief stories with you, Eric Jacobs. Jacobson and Dustin Simcoe, and then we'd like to answer some questions as well from the testimony. So I'll start with Mr. White.
Mr. White, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael White. I'm the general manager for Uber in the Midwest, and I'm here to speak in strong opposition to the insurance bill that's been put forth before you today. Uber has been operating in Minnesota for about 2.5 years now, and in that time, we've had a really strong and positive impact on the two cities where we operate, Minneapolis and St. Paul. We currently have hundreds of thousands of users who are using our service regularly to get rides, to meet a need that isn't currently satisfied by current transportation operators within these cities. They use it for all kinds of things, whether it's to supplement public transportation, to commute to work, to get home safely from an activity, a professional sports game, or after having a few drinks out at the bar. And so it's really meeting a real need in Minnesota where it hasn't been met before. And there's a unique nature to the type of opportunity or option that Uber is able to provide that enables us to be able to meet that need. And it's because we have this technology that enables us to connect a rider to a vetted and safe driver exclusively through our app. And that's really the opportunity that people really love about it. They feel safe that they're able to connect with a driver who's been vetted through the Uber system. They're able to track that driver throughout the transaction. They can see a picture of the driver who's coming to get them, the type of vehicle that's coming to get them, the license plate of that driver. They can contact that driver at any time during the transaction, and they know it's being tracked. So at any time throughout that transaction, they are able to. They know that Uber, if needed, could inform authorities or anyone else on what has occurred. On the driver side, we have thousands of drivers in Minnesota right now. Who are small businesses or entrepreneurs who are using our platform to make additional income, supplementing their other businesses or as a stopgap between other jobs, or students who are using it in their free time. So we're providing an additional economic benefit on that side. And what we've seen in cities where Uber operates is a reduction in DUIs, reduction in congestion. When people are able to get a reliable ride at times when they most need it, they're less likely to make a bad decision if they've been drinking. They're more likely to press a button and get a ride home. So I think, you know, in short, I think we bring a lot of benefits to the state. You know, one of our competitors here, Lyft, also is an operation, and they, I think, have had a similar impact. The insurance bill before you, you know, let me just kind of start by saying that there is coverage that applies at every single point throughout the time when a driver turns on the app to when they go offline and stop operating. There is no time currently in Minnesota or elsewhere when there isn't an insurance policy that covers that. So there's a word that gets thrown around, this gap coverage, and I'd like to address kind of head on the horrible incident that happened in California with Sophia Liu. Very sad. A driver, it was New Year's Eve. He was logged onto the app. He made a right turn across an intersection and struck this family, and the little 6-year-old girl was killed. And it's a really horrible incident. You know, it's one of many types of incidents that happen when people are operating vehicles, but it was definitely a very sad thing, and something that you know, I, with a 14-month-old, can definitely relate to how horrible that would have been for the family. But you should know that the insurance, there was insurance coverage, and the insurance actually paid out in that instance, and the family received the insurance coverage during that time. Now, the family has additionally hired lawyers to pursue additional compensation from Uber above and beyond what was covered by the insurance policy that covered that incident. But there was no gap in terms of insurance. There was just the family sought additional damages as a result of that very sad incident. So, to be clear, there was no gap in insurance. It was just a question, I guess, of the family pursuing additional litigation against a large company after, you know, they had a horrible incident happen. So, in that incident, and in other incidences that have happened since then, there has been no time when insurance hasn't covered it. Uber currently is doing about 1 million trips a day. And so you can imagine that with the business at large, that there are accidents that happen. There is zero litigation right now about a question about whether there's insurance during that time period. So there's not a question today about whether there's insurance coverage. And in fact, both St. Paul and Minneapolis have passed legislation that assures that the TNC's own insurance will cover the liability of the driver from the time they turn the app on up until the end of the trip. So throughout periods 1, 2, and 3 that were described earlier, in the state of Minnesota, there is coverage. Kind of shifting gears to the specifics of this bill, there are a number of things about this bill that make it absolutely untenable for Uber to operate under within the state of Minnesota. And I can summarize a few of those. First is the extreme amount of insurance coverage that's required in period 1. This was discussed a bit already. But this coverage is unprecedented, as you see in the summary sheet, and it's been acknowledged by the previous speakers, unprecedented of anywhere else in any other jurisdiction. It is leaps and bounds above, multiples above, what is required in any other state or municipality. And this issue has been taken up and answered in over 25 different municipalities, the city and state level around the country. No other municipality or state has not distinguished period 1 from the other periods. So in every other case, there's a lower limit in period 1 as compared to period 2 and 3. And that's because all other legislators have recognized that there's a difference between accepting a ride and having a commitment to now provide transportation to somebody and just simply turning on an app and either sitting in a coffee shop or driving to work or even just simply driving around. In fact, I think most people recognize that having when an app gets turned on, there's no further interaction, there's no more distraction, there's nothing more that happens at that point other than a screen is now on in your on your screen, and somebody makes a request of you, the phone beeps and you have to touch the screen. That's the extent of the interaction that's required at the time. There's no sorting through requests or trying to determine whether there's somebody out there who you want to ride. It is no more of a distraction or a liability than if you were to try and put a CD into your radio or if you were to try and set a follow the GPS instructions on your vehicle. Additionally, there's another reason why the liability is less at that time. It's because there's no commercial activity happening and there's no passengers in the car. So you might need a higher liability coverage, which is recognized in periods 2 and 3, because you have more people in the car. So if they get hurt, you need more coverage to protect them from that liability. If they're injured, you need more coverage. During period 1, there's nobody in the car. So why would you need the same amount of coverage when there's less chance of liability in period 1? It doesn't make sense, and that's why the other municipalities and states who have taken this under advisement have not had the same level amongst those two different places. So that's one major concern. I think another significant concern, which wasn't discussed previously, is the amount of uninsured and underinsured coverage that's required in this bill. This bill would have TNCs provide well, at the $1 million amount, which is the adjustment down, would have us provide 20 times the amount of underinsured and uninsured coverage as is provided by taxis, limos, or any other individual in the state. 20 times the amount. $1 million worth of uninsured and uninsured coverage is, again, unprecedented in Minnesota or elsewhere within the country. Currently, a taxi and limo driver just has to provide $50,000 worth of uninsured and underinsured coverage. So to ask TNCs to provide a coverage that is so much higher than that is really, we feel like an attempt to try and prevent us from operating in Minnesota. You're asking us to do something that is just not the case or not required of anyone else. So that's an extreme concern to us. There's also a requirement in the bill for TNCs to provide comprehensive and collision insurance. And, again, this is a concern to TNCs. Comprehensive insurance and collision insurance is optional insurance in every state within the 50 United States and every municipality. It's not a public safety issue. It's the driver's own vehicle and whether they're going to be able to cover that. And that's an optional insurance that they can choose to take or not. What this bill requires is that the TNCs provide that coverage, even if the driver has purchased comprehensive or collision insurance and then canceled it. Then we're required to then provide that coverage anyway, because the bill basically says if you've held coverage that has been canceled, now the TNCs are required to provide that. So we would be held responsible for providing comprehensive and collision insurance for drivers, even if they've canceled their own insurance policy on that, which, again, is not required of any other transportation provider in the state or any other state within the union. So, again, that it feels like there's a higher level standard that's being applied to TNCs and is not in line with the other requirements. I think there's another concern in the bill around the way that this bill actually changes drivers' own policies. So in insurance, there's a standard, it's an adhesion contract. So basically you agree that you're going to provide coverage for any activity that happens while you're driving the car, unless it's excluded. And insurance companies have great freedom to exclude whatever it is that they'd like to exclude. They can decide to exclude livery transportation, as we discussed earlier. They can exclude that. They can choose to exclude basically any coverage that they want. And then the driver, as was discussed earlier, can go to that policy, look in that policy, decide what's covered. And if it's not excluded, they know it's covered. And if it is excluded, then they know that it's not covered. And it's all very clear, and it's in that contract with that individual insured. What this bill does is it takes a change in that policy and puts it in a state statute. It says unless the policy actually adds coverage and says this is coverage, which is a whole different way of writing insurance policies that isn't the precedent today, unless it's added to that insurance policy, then it's not covered. So now an individual would have to look to a state statute to see if they're covered at this time, rather than being able to look at their own insurance policy. So again, from a consumer protection standpoint, we're very concerned about having a standard and setting a precedent where you have a statute that determines what is or isn't covered in a personal contract between an individual and their insurance company. So again, that raises some concerns. Overall, we're really just, we love operating in Minnesota. We're very happy to be here. We develop a very strong relationship with the driver partners who are operating in this and earning great money here. We're very happy to be a part, and we've had partnerships with all kinds of different businesses, sporting teams in this city. So we're in this state. We're very excited to be a part of the state commerce and to provide the service. This feels very much like we're being pushed out. It's a standard that is so much higher than any other municipality or state in the country. It feels like an attack why are we being targeted for these insurance levels that are not the case other places? And so what I would really ask you to do, and I guess one other point, is the process under which this bill has been raised is also, frankly, concerning. We work very closely in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul around developing ordinances there. This process took months to make sure it got right, provided the right public safety, acknowledged the uniqueness of this new business that has allowed us to thrive and grow in those cities. This, we have not been involved in the discussion around this in this bill until it was first introduced on Thursday last week, and I've had 2 days to react to what is in this bill. So I don't have an amendment to offer you today. I wish I did, but I can tell you that through the readings of this, we simply couldn't operate under the requirements that are written here in this bill. And we want to be able to continue to operate here, and we want to partner with legislators like you to develop good policy that acknowledges the uniqueness of our business. So with that, you know, I know I've taken a lot of time, and I appreciate you allowing me to speak. I make myself available to any questions you may have about my testimony or the bill or how we operate within the state currently.
Thank you. Nice job. And we wanted to give you extra time because the proponents of the bill had more time, and you did a nice job. Representative Atkins.
One specific brief point. If this bill passes, Uber shuts down. Yes or no?
Mr. White.
In its current form, we have left other municipalities for a bill that is less onerous than this, notably San Antonio.
Okay.
So we couldn't operate under this bill as it is today. So a vote in support of this bill is a vote to have Uber no longer operate in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. White. Representative Cresha.
Thank you. And just to follow up to Representative Atkins, if this bill happens, is it a financial reason you couldn't shut down or a liability?
So,
Mr. White.
The problem here is that there's two pieces. One, there's a financial responsibility of developing and creating these products for insurance that are, again, unprecedented. And it also establishes a standard that is well beyond any other operator within the state. So we're not in a position where we can operate competitively with such onerous requirements that are above and beyond other transportation providers in the state. So that's the reason why we couldn't operate on these requirements.
Representative Cresha.
Cash problem or a liability on the books? Which one?
Mr. White.
So it's both. I mean, I think there's an element of trying to find insurance policies that provide this level of coverage and provide the level of service in a cost-effective manner that we do today. We don't feel we can operate and achieve both of those goals.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. White. Why don't we go and proceed with the next testifier? You want to go ahead and identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
committee, by the way, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm an Uber driver. So for me, what does Uber mean to me? Uber represents flexibility, entrepreneurial opportunities, and more freedom with my and time with my family. Before I started Uber, I was in the hair industry and worked horrible hours, spending multiple time and days away from my family, as well as every weekend, and having no quality time with my family. This took away time that I had to nurture and spend time with my 7-year-old daughter when she needed me the most. When Uber came into my life, I saw a way to be able to create a schedule that worked for my family without sacrificing my income, and I was able to spend more time with my daughter, so I can now take her to school, I can pick her up, and I can be at home with her when she's sick, and I'd have to hire a babysitter or send her somewhere else. Also, on her days off and her vacations that she has, when they have spring break, winter break, I had to go to work and I had to find somebody to take care of my daughter to be able to provide, which then meant that my income was getting even lower, so I was paying out more money to a babysitter. Now with this, I'm able to stay at home with her and teach her my morals and my values in order to her to be an independent woman versus asking somebody else to raise my daughter and teach them her morals and their values. Uber also means to me getting people home safe from long nights of drinking, being at sporting events, or possibly just going to the airport to get to catch the flight to go on a business trip. I personally have driven many people that are going on business trips. I've driven people that have had long nights at the bar that have told me that they rely on Uber because it's a much safer way of transportation. They feel that we're more reliable. They feel that they can depend on us and that we have been more professional than the standard mode of transportation prior. Increasing this insurance and introducing this bill directly affects the riders and the cost that it takes them to get home, which means that there's going to be less drivers, if Uber at all anymore, which again then puts me back into my loss of income, hectic hours, spending time away from my family. And as an entrepreneur, I'm asking that you oppose the bills in these current forms, but do work with Uber to create workable legislation. Because I drive for Uber and not some other company, I was able to be here to be talking to you guys today, and I'm open for any questions if anybody has any.
Thank you, sir. And I'm sorry, I was talking when you said your name. Could you repeat your name, please?
My name is Dustin Simcoe.
Thank you, Mr. Simcoe. I appreciate it. Next, go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Eric Jacobson. I am a driver for Uber. I wore green today, not because of the St. Patty's Day, but to represent the grass that the elephants will kill if this legislation passes. Just a joke. I don't have anything prepared, but I just wanted to say that when I started driving for Uber, it was a time where I was extreme time of need financially for me and for my family, and I reached out to Uber and to see if that was going to be an option. I wasn't aware of the service, wasn't aware how busy it would be, where it would it be viable for me and work for me and for my family. I've been driving since August of last year, and over that time frame, I've gone from a position of extreme need to a position of being able to now have choices for me and for my family. I operate another business from my home. I'm an entrepreneur. And most of the time when my phone is on, I'm waiting for a ride, I'm at my house, and I'm working on my other business. I don't feel that's a place where additional multi-million dollar insurance coverage needs to happen. Uber currently does cover the drivers as a primary insurance option, both when we're on our way to pick up a customer and driving that person to their required destination. I'd just like to say that it's been a great blessing for me, for my family. Allows me to be able to be with my kids, like you say, and have a flexible scenario that I can work around other business opportunities and give me the ability to have some options for me and for my family. Thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Is there anyone else that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Mr. O'Rourke?
Thank you.
Mr. Rourke, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Capo Rourke, and I am representing a coalition of taxicab business owners. Our coalition has about, counts for close to 900 taxis in the Twin Cities area. To give you a perspective, the city of Minneapolis has about 900 licensed taxis, along with the MAC, Bloomington, and St. Paul also have additional taxis. All of our owners, business owners who have more than 10 vehicles currently have up to $2 million and more than the $1 million that is currently presented in this bill. And our coverage is different. The coverage for taxi cabs is 24 hours comprehensive coverage. So there are a lot of individuals who are owner-operators of their taxi cab. If they're driving around and they're going to get groceries and they get in a car accident, it's on their business commercial insurance. And another issue that comes up, and one of the reasons that we have 24-hour coverage, is actually today is a great example of how this happens. So traditionally on this day, I would be with my father and my uncle, and we would usually take a cab to downtown St. Paul, and we would usually become friendly with that cab driver, and he would give us his card and say, give me a call at the end of the night, and I'll come and pick you up. And we would give that person a call. Sometimes that cab driver would charge us the standard rate, and sometimes he or she would go off the books and do a cash transaction. I can tell you this also happens with Uber cabs. In fact, last summer, a private investigator was, in the course of 5 days, able to procure five different rides for a standard payment of $20. Those rides did not show up on the Uber app. Those rides were never accepted, but yet they were given. So my question is, what happens in those situations when those drivers become friendly with one of their regular customers and maybe go off the books? What happens if they get in a car accident during that period and there is a passenger who has paid a fee? What level of coverage will apply during that? That is why the cab companies in our current model have 24 hours business coverage and comprehensive coverage. So that is all we have to say, and I'll stand for any questions about our policies.
Thank you, Mr. O'Rourke. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Faye Horton. I've been an Uber driver for about 8 months. I work full-time and I use Uber part-time. I'm going to say about 99% of the rides that I pick up choose Uber over the local taxi cabs for several reasons. One, they said they feel safe. The rides aren't as bumpy. The drivers aren't making like illegal turns. They aren't running through stop signs or red lights. Number two reason why they choose Uber over taxis in St. Paul and Minneapolis that are the riders that ride with me, they say they don't feel safe because the driver is on their phone talking the entire time. They're making phone calls, they're accepting phone calls, and they're talking the entire time, missing lights and sliding in ice and so forth and so on. They said they have tried Uber and they felt safer in the cars. I am a mother of a 23-year-old, and so when I get drivers in the middle of the night that maybe have had a little bit too much to drink, regardless of their age, I feel safe knowing that they're riding with me because I am paying attention to the roads. I am not on my phone, and I am interacting with them and making sure that they get home safe. I have had several riders get in my car and fall asleep on a 15-minute ride because they felt comfortable with us. Uber allows me to be there for my children at night and versus being in a store or somewhere else supplementing my income where I can't get away if they need me. I can just turn the app off and go attend to my family. I have a very sick mother who's deathly ill. I can also turn the app off if I see a phone call coming from my sister. There are so many reasons why Uber works for me and my family and a lot of the riders that we take in on a regular basis. So if there's any more questions, I'm free to answer questions.
Ms. Horton, thank you very much. You did a nice job testifying. Is there anyone else that's in the audience that wants to come down either side of the bill? And the reason I keep saying that is because we have some people waiting here for the next bill. So what I know what the reaction is going to be from the members, but I think what we're going to do is hear the next bill. We're going to lay this over for right now. Hear the next bill. That's going to be relatively quick. We're going to try to get out of here as fast as we can, and then we'll recess until probably 6:30 or something like that and come back and finish the bill. Well, we have... Let's see how things go with Mr. DePasquale. So with that, we'll lay House File 1783 on the table, and we'll get back to it. Gentlemen, I appreciate your patience. And Mr. DePasquale, I appreciate your patience and your waiting here. Representative Lunan. Representative Lunan and Mr. DePasquale, I appreciate your patience. Let's try to get through this as quickly as we can. With that, Representative Lunan, if you want to go ahead and move 1793.
Move Bill 1793.
To where? To go to the floor?
To the Committee on Civil Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is with one exception, kind of a technical cleanup bill. Commissioner DePasquale, I've been working with him on this. It's refreshing to see what an effect this is going to have on the racing industry. I'm the representative from the Shakopee area, and horse racing is a big deal to us. And his background in regulatory law is really going to come in handy. Also, the fact that his objectivity, because he comes in and just looks at the data, and there isn't any personalities or anything. And in working with all the parties involved, and he's done a good job of that. And you see in your packet letters from all of the parties buying in on this. The bill that's before you is not how the bill started. This has been a collaborative effort, and so first thing I want to do is move the A-15 amendment.
Thank you. I was just going to ask you that, Representative Lunan. And Representative Lunan, you've hit on a kind of a constant Commerce Committee theme, and I want to tell you and Mr. DePasquale and Mr. Holton and others, thank you all for working on this. I know this has been a lot of meetings and a lot of time, and we appreciate it. With that, we'll move the Representative Lunan has moved the A-15 amendment. We will go ahead and vote on that. All those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A-15 is now on the bill. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm going to hand this off to the commissioner, but the crux of this bill is some technical cleanups. It updates. There is one thing that's past technical, which is updating some of the fee schedules for the vendors out at the horse track. By statute, those fees are to represent a reimbursement or an identification for the expenses incurred by the regulatory body to do their job. There's also some language in here at Canterbury, for instance. I ask you both horse tracks. They have a card club that was via a law that passed in this body that helped supplement the purses. We're cleaning up some of that, and we're also going to offer multi-year licenses for the trainers out there. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'll turn it over to the commissioner.
I'm just wondering if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
And I appreciate the hard work that's gone into this. Unless there's controversy or there's folks that are opposed to this, I think at least on behalf of our side of the table, we're happy to, we've gone through it, we think it's fine. But are you aware, Representative Lunan, of any controversy or any opposition, or maybe Mr. Chairman?
Representative Atkins, that is a good point, and I think that, as I said earlier, there has been a lot of work that's gone on behind the scenes on this, and we'll let Mr. DePasquale comment on that, but I think it's a good point to be brought up.
Oh, absolutely, and I wasn't trying to cut off Mr. DePasquale, but I think if you've got 30 seconds worth of telling us the highlights, and then we're comfortable just moving the bill out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, and Mr. Representative Lunan, thank you, and I will cover it with Uber-like speed.
topical, very topical.
Since I started 15 months ago, I became aware of a lot of contradictions and ambiguities in the existing legislation, which is not to criticize the 30 or more years of history that lies behind this bill, but in its many amendments, it got to be a little bit difficult to interpret. So the main thrust of this bill is to clarify and simplify. I asked Deputy Director Skirto to join me up here because he brokered an agreement between the horse persons associations and the tracks to simplify the contribution of to purses. and make it more easy to administer. And as Representative Lunan said, there are financial aspects of the bill in the sense that we do need to revise our licensing fees in order to match our operating costs, which we're required to do by existing law. I'm happy to answer questions, but I'm confident that I have the support we need to move forward, and I thank you for reviewing and supporting the bill.
Thank you, Mr. DePasquale.
No further comments.
Thank you. And I also want to say, and I really mean it, I know you gentlemen have all put a lot of work in on this, and I want to thank Mr. Holton, who's apparently not coming down, but thank you very much, Mr. Sampson. I know a lot of collaboration went into this, and I appreciate it. Is there anyone else in the audience that does want to come down and speak? Any questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Lunan, we'll give you the final word.
I ask for a green vote on this. My experience on this has demonstrated this is how a commissioner should work with the people that are affected by the legislature that he's proposing. So I ask for a yes vote.
Thank you. With that, Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 1793, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Very Irish of you. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. 1793 is sent to civil law. Thank you, Mr. DePasquale. Thank you, members. And with that, we are going to recess till about 6:30 or the call of the chair. I know Representative Sundin, I wish we would have gotten done. I think we're done with all the testifiers, but I know that there were a lot of member questions left, so let's come back at 6:30 and try to get through it as quickly as we can. Thank you, members. With that, we are in recess. We will call the House Commerce Committee meeting back to order. We are out of recess. Members, thank you all for your patience. Thank you to those in the audience. And I think everybody kind of knows what we're going to do. While we had laid, where's my bill, 1783 on the table. So I think what we're going to do is leave it on the table. We will adjourn for the night. We'll come back tomorrow at our regular committee time. We'll take this bill up first, and we'll let the two sides get together and try to work out a compromise that makes things a little bit better. But our goal is to get this bill out of here tomorrow. Not necessarily, it's not going to be the final product. The negotiations, I think, can still continue at that point. I think everybody gets that it's not quite ready for the floor, and we have time. We don't have to hear it on the floor. I don't know where it is in the Senate, but I think that leaves us time to kind of get some of the details ironed out and maybe get at least closer to that elusive piece in the valley.
But we'd all sure like it to be the final product.
If it is the final product, that would be fine with all of us. In any event, let's try to get a compromise worked out sometime tonight, and then we can come back tomorrow and look at what the compromise is and vote this bill out of here. Any questions, members? It's a little bit of an unusual process, but I think it's. I think we saw that there were some questions on this, and this will help get a better product out of here. Seeing no questions, thank you all very much for coming back. Thank you to everybody in the audience, and we'll work on it overnight.
And Mr. Chair, just
Representative Swidzinski,
the folks that are in the room that may want to, if they want to start a conversation in maybe 15 or 20 minutes, if they want to meet in 491, my office, we can.
That's very nice of you, Representative Swidzinski. Good idea. With that, members, happy St. Patrick's Day, and we'll see you tomorrow. We are adjourned.